Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. As we go through this, one cannot think that all's well. It's obviously, I will just say there's a font in the newsprint industry called apocalypse, and that's kind of where we are. We really need to have that big of and a bold enough assertion so that people can start recognizing, you know, how close we are to the brink, just due to the fact that our government has been waging war and it's been blatant. We got Paul back with us, and so welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
I think the last words that you said off air were juicy. The fact is, news is happening all around us, but it is so much better to be focused on what we really need to understand so that we know how to actually start moving forward. We got to stop reacting. I mean, society has lived in, creating action and response or action and reaction. And we got to stop that. We need to be the ones acting, and we need to be acting with deliberate, direction to end their ability to continue to act and the ability for others to continually react. It's done. The supreme law of the land doesn't allow those things.
Right.
In context to attacks, unconstitutional behavior, and so forth. And so, I'm literally at the point where the medical freedom petition is in its final rough draft, getting ready to be sent out. So I am, looking forward to actually getting that behind me and moving into the jurisdiction of the court, or actually I should say legislative powers are vested in Congress only.
Yes.
And so that way we can actually, start creating assertions, and then we can go back into, and I plan on going back into the petitions that we have and adding references to actually say, hey, this petition absolutely supports this. And what it'll actually do is these petitions will be so intertwined that groups won't actually be able to provide one petition by itself. Just in case you get a group out there, well, we support this, but we don't want to support these other ones.
Mm-hmm.
These petitions will be hinging on artifacts and or proof and evidence is provided in other petitions.
Right.
So in other words, they all become, integral to each other anyway, mm-hmm. or at least they build upon each other. But so where we were at, we were with, I believe it's Mr. Lenore, and he was,
right.
He's an anti-federalist making comments and complaints about the commission. And we were going to get into exclusive legislation, which is a part of Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, that Congress shall have the exclusive legislation authority over what we call the District of Columbia and territories of the United States until they become states. So go ahead.
Okay, so you got something highlighted here, but there's a line in this first sentence highlighted in blue, and I want to read it.
We already covered that yesterday. A constitution ought to be understood by everyone.
Understood by everyone.
Right. I actually read that first few sentences.
Okay.
Okay.
It appears to me that instead of securing the sovereignty of the states, it is calculated to melt them down into one solid empire. If the citizens of this state lack a consolidated government, I hope they will have virtue enough to secure their rights. I'm sorry to make use of the expression, but it appears to me to be a scheme to reduce this government to an aristocracy. It guarantees a republican form of government to the states when all these powers are in Congress. It will only be a form. It will be past recovery when Congress has the power of the purse and the sword. The power of the sword is in explicit terms given to it. The power of direct taxation gives the purse. They may prohibit the trial by jury, which is a most sacred and valuable right. There's nothing contained in this Constitution to bar them from it. The federal courts have also appellate cognizance of law and fact, the sole case of which is to deprive the people of that trial, which is optional in them to grant or not. We find no provision against infringement on the rights of conscience. Ecclesiastical courts may be established which will be destructive to our citizens. They may make any establishment they think proper. They have also an exclusive legislation in their 10-mile square, to which may be added their power over the militia, who may be carried thither and kept there for life. Should any one grumble at their acts, he would be deemed a traitor, and perhaps taken up and carried to the exclusive legislation, and there tried without a jury. We are told there is no cause to fear. When we consider the great powers of Congress, there is great cause of alarm. They can disarm the militia. If they were armed, they would be a source against great oppressions. The laws of a great empire are difficult to be executed. If the laws of the Union were oppressive, they could not carry them into effect if the people were possessed a proper means of defense. This guy's animated.
He's almost repeating what Mason said in Virginia, but he's ignoring how, you know, these were all refuted in Virginia because, like he was saying, that, you know, the power needs to be with the people. Where were you when they read that the Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union? That is the final check, because they can't force the people to do unconstitutional acts.
Right.
Because we're the ones that are doing it.
And the militia are the people, like you just said.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
We're Absolutely. The ones doing it. So amazing. It was hard for me to read his arguments.
Uh huh. Okay? But okay. And here's another the same guy, Lenore, but now he talks about slaves.
Okay. We're ready. Much has been said of taxation and the inequality of it on the states, but nothing has been said of the mode of furnishing men. In what proportion are the states to furnish men? Is in proportion to the whites and blacks? What does he mean by furnishing men? I don't know what he means.
Keep reading.
Okay, I presume it is. This state has 100,000 blacks. By this constitution, 50 Negroes equal to 30 whites. This state, therefore, besides the proportion she must raise for her white people, must furnish an additional number for her blacks. The proportion is as 30 is to 50. Suppose there be a state to the northward that has 60,000 persons. This state must furnish as many men for blacks as that whole state, exclusive of those she must furnish for her whites. Slaves, instead of strengthening, weaken the state. The regulation, therefore, will greatly injure it and the other southern states. There is another clause which I do not perhaps understand. I'm going to pause here because I'm not sure I understand what he's saying. Furnish men for what? For the militia?
Yes, for the militia. And so, yeah, that should have become a little more obvious. And this is why he talks about the strategic, you know, problem of slaves. They're not strengthening. They're weakening the state. So, okay. In other words, this guy may be a real contrarian for the South, because he may not be a proponent for slavery, and he's definitely an opponent to the Constitution. So, anyway.
Okay. All right. Slaves, instead of strengthening, weaken the state. The regulation, therefore, will greatly injure it and the other southern states. There's another clause, which I do not perhaps understand. The power of taxation seems to be not to extend to the lands of the people of the United States. For the rule of taxation is the number of the whites and 3/5 of the blacks. Should it be the case that they have no power of taxing this object? Must not direct taxation be hard upon the greater part of this state? I am not confident that it is so, but it appears to me that they cannot lay taxes on this object. This will oppress the poor people who have large families of whites. And no slaves to assist them in cultivating the soil. Although the taxes are to be laid on proportion to 3/5 of the Negroes and all the whites, another disadvantage to this state will arise from it. This state has made a contract with its citizens, the public securities and certificates I allude to. I don't know what he's talking about there, but okay. These may be negotiated to men who live in other states. Should that be the case, these gentlemen will have demands against this state on that account. The Constitution points out the mode of recovery. It must be in federal court only because controversies between a state and the citizens, another state, are cognizable only in the federal courts. They cannot be paid but in gold and silver. Actual specie will be recovered in that court. This would be in an intolerable grievance without remedy.
Okay, so it's seeming like, you know, he's really an anti-Constitution guy, but he's also making arguments that really point out the problems of slavery, because he pointed out that the taxation would be greater on a, you know, on a household that had no slaves.
Right.
So my read is it would be greater. Yeah, more oppressive, because if you let's say you have a household of 100, you know, on a plantation, mm-hmm. and you have 10, you know, 10 whites and 90 slaves, then your taxation based on apportionment would be less for you.
Right.
If that's how they collected taxes. If they collected income tax or something like that directly, then that's how, but that's not how it was being done. Direct taxes were apportioned to the states based on apportionment. In other words, based on representation. And so the majority of all the revenues were basically pursued and obtained via imposts and excises. Direct taxes, the federal government very rarely went there.
So why did he even bring this up? It sounds like he's muddying the water with something that wasn't happening.
So it was already talked about, but they didn't know. They saw this ability of direct tax, and they said, oh, well, that, you know, they're going to open up the heavens and just tax us and tax us. Because, I mean, there was this subjection or the subjective position, and this was already brought up. I forget which debate it was, but I remember it being brought up. And they basically said, look, in many, and I think it was Virginia, and I believe it was Monroe that was bringing this up, that many nations don't even apply a direct tax, that they make all of their money necessary from their imposts.
Right.
Right. And you got to look at it.
Service deficient.
Right. And so when you actually look at, because I've actually looked at the financial statements made by Hamilton, and the majority of the taxes that were being brought in, because they hadn't even created excise taxes by 1792. They hadn't even started the taxes. They were in the process of creating the Assumption Act. And so as they were going down this path, I believe their budget was $15 million. That's how much they spent. And their income, their revenue was $10 million. So they were in a deficit of $5 million. But that was all on imposts. They hadn't even started excise taxes, because this is where Hamilton started playing with the idea of taxing the sales of horses and these other types of things. And then eventually they created the whiskey tax. They started creating those types of taxes so that they could actually turn their deficit into a positive.
Right.
Right. And so, I mean, there's a lot of misnomers regarding taxation, revenue, and those types of things that people are, you know, engaged in, you know, looking at it, at these things as problems, when there's really nothing there. As I constantly state, because we see these things, the libertarians use this to manipulate people. The taxation is theft. As a matter of fact, I happened to read, and I was engaged in this this meme that was, and I'll just kind of pull it up. This was the Nebraskans. What was the name of the group? Nebraskans Against Government Overreach. Now, you'd think that that might be Republican, but the meme itself was definitely libertarian. And the meme basically says this: What's a scam that's so normalized that we don't even realize it's a scam anymore? And, you know, everybody in this group was saying, taxation, taxation, that's the scam. Well, hold on here. The real scam that nobody realizes is it's not taxation, it's spending.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the argument, they said, taxation has never been a problem under this Constitution. It has been unconstitutional spending. So the irony is that everybody in this group thinks taxation is the problem when it's spending that drives taxation.
Right.
Where are the memes that complain about government spending?
Right.
Right. And there you go. And now you see that, as this says, what is a scam that's so normalized that we don't even realize it's a scam anymore? Unconstitutional spending is truly the scam, because right. there's plenty of people pointing to taxation, but they're really not right. pointing to the source of the problem. So anyway, back to the ratification debates. I don't know if I answered your questions on this.
Go ahead.
So clearly this guy is bringing in some very unique arguments. I thought it was worthy to bring in. Just due to the fact that he was, you know, how can I say it? It was hard to nail this guy down. He was definitely anti-constitution, and he appeared to be anti-slavery, too. He was an outlier.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Right.
So, and I guess he goes on
In
exclusive legislation, right?
Well, we already covered that. We covered the slaves. So the next person that speaks after him is Mr. Speight, and Mr. Speight speaks on the commission.
Oh, that, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, there we go. All right.
All right, so it's all in blue.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I'm one of those who formed this Constitution. The gentleman says we exceeded our powers. I deny the charge. We were sent with a full power to amend the existing system. This involved every power to make every alteration necessary to ameliorate and render it perfect. It cannot be said that we arrogated powers altogether inconsistent with the object of our delegation. There is a clause which expressly provides for future amendments, and it is still in your power. What the convention has done is a mere proposal. It was found impossible to improve the old system without changing its very form. For by that system, the three great branches of government are blended together. All will agree that the concession of a power to a government so constructed is dangerous. The proposing a new system to be established by the assent and ratification of nine states arose from the necessity of the case. It was thought extremely hard that one state or even three or four states should be able to prevent necessary alterations. The very refractory conduct of Rhode Island in uniformly opposing every wise and judicious measure taught us how impolitic it would be to put the general welfare in the power of a few members of the union. It was therefore thought by the convention that if so great a majority as nine states should adopt it, it would be right to establish it. It was a recommendation by Congress to the state legislatures to refer it to the people of their different states. Our assembly has confirmed what they have done by proposing it to the consideration of the people. It was there and not here that the objection should have been made. The convention is therefore to consider the Constitution and whether it be proper for the government of the people of America. And had it been proposed by any one individual under these circumstances, it would be right to consider whether it be good or bad. The gentleman has insinuated that this Constitution, instead of securing our liberties, is a scheme to enslave us. He has produced no proof, but rests it on his bare assertion, an assertion which I am astonished to hear, after the ability with which every objection has been fully and dearly refuted in the course of our debates. I am, for my part, conscious of having had nothing in view but the liberty and happiness of my country, and I believe every member of that convention was actuated by motives equally sincere and politic.
And patriotic. And so
patriotic.
So let me throw this out here, because there's a gentleman out there who is a John Birch Society that has hinged, you know, a challenge to anybody that could prove that this Constitution was not a runaway Constitution, that he would give you $10,000. And so it is my – folks, you got it right here. This, along with Madison and others, and as a matter of fact, the question is not to leave it to him whether you've proved it or not. I believe that he should actually have to go to a court where it is a jury by the, you know, by our peers. In other words, not John Bircher's, where it's a stacked court, but a jury of, you know, people that are completely unknowing anything about the ratification of the Constitution so that they can hear the evidence and decide for themselves. And the bottom line is this, that all of these states challenged the concept that they exceeded their commission, and had that been the case, because they solved this. As a matter of fact, we heard the language in Virginia, and we've actually, one of these days, I'll bequeath the DHRC's documents. So I'll have all of the documents of the ratification debates that are ever available that they've been able to uncover. They're about, folks, if you, they're about $3,000 if you want to gift those to me. But I believe every state in this union should have those documents and have them in an electronic form, so that they are searchable, so that they can be, you know, properly utilized in a government fashion. But all this being said, the fact is that all of these states actually did refute this charge that they've violated. And here he clearly states that what they did was they proposed, they recommended a new system. They didn't go and actually fix the old one because they couldn't. They had to change and create the separations of power. Does that make sense? Because he clearly pointed to that.
Right. Yeah, right. They didn't change it. They made a new proposal and left it up to this people in the states to.
And they were actually, and in the commission, when you read the commission, that's actually there to give them a, you know, a proposal for, you know, either amend this or give us something of, you know, creating a new government of, you know, what you would recommend. And they did exactly that.
And where is that commission?
What do you mean? Do you want to see it? You want to read it?
Yeah, if I wanted to read the commission, or if the audience wanted to read the commission, where would they find it?
I actually read that before we got into the ratification base, before you got involved. And so I'll be happy to give that to you so that you can go through those. In Madison's Federalist Papers, number 40, he actually cites them. So what we can do, and why don't we just add this to when we're finished with the ratification debates, we will read Madison's assertions in the Federalist Papers where he actually cites them. And so bottom line, when you actually read these things, and then when you really look at the outcome, the states, 12 of the states out of 13, ended up ratifying the Constitution. Even if you just said 11, mm-hmm. you would come away from a majority of that jury basically agreeing with the same, that they did not exceed their commission, that this is a legitimate document for consideration and for ratification. It was the way to move forward. And that's what these men did. I hope Mr. Brown has that $10,000 and the ability to cover the legal costs, because I would highly recommend anybody just, you know, that has the money. Mark Meckler could do this, and Mark Meckler could really, and I don't want to see that, because I don't want to see the wind in the convention of state sails, because I'm not a proponent for that, but I'm not a proponent for lying and being deceitful and sullying this Constitution. I mean, Paul, you know personally my background of why I have such an affinity for the Constitution, and it's very mm-hmm. deep and personal to me. And so right. I think it's very important that we always focus on the truth and try to bring forward the truth. So anyway, and I don't think, I think it was just grandstanding. I don't think he was really in the position. So we're going to be going into a break here. So Paul will be right back after this hard break. Folks, let me just finish what I meant to say, is I honestly think it was hyperbole by Mr. Brown and the John Birch Society. I think that they have the high ground as long as they are the judges, because you'll never change their mind. But I'll bet you they would completely back off if they said, I'm willing to go into a common law grand jury and a jury of our peers where, you know, they could be eliminated if they have bias. We'll be right back.
Set the record straight. Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as I was going into break, and I was trying to really rush this out, Paul, and you probably didn't hear this because it's okay. The technical problems. In going into a common law grand jury to make this determination, because this would actually assist in the definitizing of the Constitution as well, and you know I'm a huge advocate for that, that mm-hmm. a common law grand jury, you can actually, you know, seat your jury in chambers. In other words, instead of openly asking questions, you can sit down and ask people what they know regarding the Constitution, the ratification debates, the commission, and all of that without going into the details of it, so that you can determine whether this person has already set biases or whether they're even informed. Because if they're informed on the subject, then they have a likelihood of a bias.
Okay.
And so that way you can literally seat, individuals on a jury that have no information whatsoever, because that's the best way to move forward in determining, based on the facts alone of this case, whether they exceeded their commission or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm confident that that jury would rule in favor of the fact that the delegates that went there did not exceed their commission. They actually arose to the occasion and exceeded expectations. And so, anyway, with that.
Okay.
With that, let's move on, because now he starts going and defending this concept of an aristocracy.
Okay.
Okay.
This is still Mr. Spade.
Mm-hmm.
He says that it will tend to aristocracy. Where is the aristocratical part of it? It is ideal. I always thought an aristocracy was that government where the few governed the many, or where the rulers were hereditary. This is a very different government from that. I never read of such an aristocracy. The first branch are representatives chosen freely by the people at large. This must be allowed upon all hands to be democratical. The next is the Senate, chosen by the people. And I gotta stop here. I think in this case we're using the right terminology for democracy, because the people are voting for their representatives.
Yes, they get to choose by a majority. Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's where majority works. All right. So mm-hmm. the next is the Senate, chosen by the people in a secondary manner through the medium of their delegates in the legislature. This cannot be aristocratical. They are chosen for 6 years, but one-third of them go out every second year and are responsible to the state legislatures. The president is elected for 4 years. By whom? By those who are elected in such manner as the state legislatures think proper. I hope the gentleman will not pretend to call this an aristocratical feature. The privilege of representation is secured in the most positive and unequivocal terms and cannot be evaded. The gentleman has again brought on the trial by jury. The federal convention, sir, had no wish to destroy the trial by jury. It is 3 or 4 days before then. It was 3 or 4 days before then. There were a variety of objections to any one mode. It was thought impossible to fall upon any one mode, but what would produce some inconveniences. I cannot now recollect all the reasons given. Most of them have been amply detailed by other gentlemen here. I should suppose that if the representatives of 12 states, with many able lawyers among them, could not form any exceptionable mode, this convention could hardly be able to do it. As to the subject of religion, I thought what had been said would fully satisfy that gentleman and every other. No power is given to the general government to interfere with it at all. Any act of Congress on this subject would be a usurpation. No sect is preferred to another. Every man has a right to worship the Supreme Being in the manner he thinks proper. No test is required. All men of equal capacity and integrity are equally eligible to offices. Temporal violence might make mankind wicked, but never religious. A test would enable the prevailing sect to persecute the rest. I do not suppose an infidel or any such person will ever be chosen to any office unless the people themselves be of the same opinion. He says that Congress may establish ecclesiastical courts. I do not know what part of the Constitution warrants that assertion. It is impossible. No such power is given them. The gentleman advises such amendments as would satisfy him and proposes a mode of amending before ratifying. If we do not adopt first, we are no more a part of the Union than any foreign power. It will be also throwing away the influence of our state to propose amendments as a condition of our ratification. If we adopt first, our representatives will have a proportionable weight in bringing about amendments, which will not be the case if we do not adopt. It is adopted by 10 states already. The question is, so I want to make a point here. It's already adopted by 10 states. So the Constitution is now in effect.
Yep.
Okay.
Right. So he's asking saying, the ultimate question. The question then is, right, go ahead.
Right. Yeah, okay. It is adopted by 10 states already. The question then is not whether the Constitution be good, but whether we will or will not confederate with the other states. The
there
gentleman
you go.
Supposes the, huh?
There you go. Whether we're going to be a right. part of it or not.
Right. And the gentleman supposes that the liberty of the press is not secured. The Constitution does not take it away. It says nothing of it. It can do nothing to injure it. But it is secured by the Constitution of every state in the Union in the most ample manner. Okay.
Right.
The same person is speaking, Mr. Spate, right? And so now he's gone to exclusive legislation.
Right.
He objects to giving the government exclusive legislation in a district not exceeding 10 miles square, although the previous consent and cession of the state within which it may be is required. Is it to be supposed that the representatives of the people will make regulations therein dangerous to liberty? Is there the least color of pretext for saying that the militia will be carried to and kept there for life? Where is there any power to do this? The power of calling forth the militia is given for the common defense. And can we suppose that our own representatives, chosen for so short a period, will dare to pervert a power given for the general protection to an absolute oppression? But the gentleman has gone farther and says that any man who will complain of their oppressions or write against a usurpation may be deemed a traitor and tried as such in the 10-mile square without a jury. What an astonishing representation. Why did not the gentleman look at the Constitution and see their... I'm sorry, GR. It is hard for me to read this without agreeing with this.
Yeah, guy. Yeah. I mean, he's kind of slapping him, right?
Right, you're right. Why did not the gentleman look at the Constitution and see their powers? Treason is there defined. It says expressly, the treason against the United States shall consist only in levying a war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Complaining, therefore, or writing cannot be treason. Here, Mr. Lenore arose and said he meant misprison. What's a misprison?
You know, to falsely imprison, right?
Okay. He meant misprison of treason. The same reason holds against that, too. The liberty of the press being secured creates an additional security. Persons accused cannot be tried without a jury. The same article provides that, quote, the trial of all crimes shall be by jury, end quote. They cannot be carried to the 10-mile square. But the same clause adds, quote, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crime shall have been committed, end quote. He's made another objection, that land might not be taxed, and the other taxes might fall heavily on the poor people. Congress has a power to lay taxes, and no article is exempted or excluded. The proportion of each state may be raised in the most convenient manner. The census or enumeration provided is meant for the salvation and benefit of the southern states. It was mentioned that land ought to be the only object of temptation. As an acre of land in the northern states is worth many acres in the southern states, this would have greatly oppressed the latter. It was then judged that the number of people, as therein provided, was the best criterion for fixing the proportion of each state, and that proportion in each state to be raised in the most easy manner for the people. But he has started another objection, which I never heard before. The Congress may call for men in proportion to the number of Negroes. The article with respect to requisitions of men is entirely done away. Men are to be raised by bounty. Suppose it had not been done away. The eastern states could not impose on us a man for every black. It was not the case during the war, nor ever could be. But the quotas of men are entirely done away. He just asked this guy, did you even bother to read this thing?
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, he goes on. Another objection he makes is that the federal courts will have cognizance of contracts between the state and citizens of another state, and that public securities negotiated by our citizens to those of other states will be recoverable specie in those courts against this state. They cannot be negotiated. What do these certificates say? Merely that the person therein named shall, for a particular service, receive so much money. They're not negotiable. The money must be demanded for them in the name of those therein mentioned. No other person has a right. There can be no danger, therefore, in this respect. The gentleman has made other objections, but they have been so fully answered and clearly refuted by several gentlemen in the course of the debates that I shall pass them by unnoticed. I cannot, however, conclude without observing that I'm amazed that he should call the powers of the general government indefinite. It is the first time I heard the objection. I will venture to say they are better defined than the powers of any government he ever heard of. Smack!
Right. Okay. So... I'm venturing to say, again, that I think I was right, that this guy, Mr. Lenore, was truly an outlier, that he was an anti-slave person as well as a, you know, anti-constitution. So
okay.
I have no idea, you know, what that meant, you know, back in those days, but I think that he might have damaged his reputation, you know, by those comments, among many of the men in these debates. And so the next one, because we already covered that, goes all the way down to Mr. Iredell regarding the abuse of power. So let's pick up that one. And what day is this? Is this the same day? Yeah, this is the same day. And just so you know, folks, this is Wednesday, July 30th.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Abuse of powers. The general ground of the objection seems to be that the power proposed to the general government may be abused. If we give no power, such as may not be abused, we shall give none. For all delegated powers may be abused. There are two extremes equally dangerous to liberty. They are tyranny and anarchy. The medium between these two is a true government to protect the people. In my opinion, this Constitution is well calculated to guard against both these extremes. The possibility of general abuses ought not to be urged, but particular ones pointed out. A gentleman who spoke some time ago, Mr. Lenoir, observed that the government might make it treason to write against the most arbitrary proceedings. He corrected himself afterwards by saying he meant misprison of treason. But in the correction, he committed as great a mistake as he did at first. Where is the power given them to do this? They have power to define and punish practices and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations. They have no power to define any other crime whatever. This will show how apt gentlemen are to commit mistakes. I'm convinced on the part of the worthy member, it was not designed, but arose merely from inattention. Oh,
so
Mr. Lamar.
Yeah, so let me, well, he just said that they have no power to, you know, other than to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. They have no power to define any other crime, whatever. And right. Clearly, we hear the Supreme Court define a crime of CO2, a crime of this, a crime of, are you kidding me?
Right.
In other words, this only shows the, you know, the lack of understanding of the Constitution today.
Right. So Mr. Lunar responds, says he arose and declared that he meant that those punishments might be inflicted by them within the 10-mile square, where they would have exclusive powers of legislation. I think Mr. Lunar is kind of backing up really fast.
Yep, and then Mr. Irinell comes right back and goes into this. Continued.
Okay. Enumerated.
Like, in other words, the way it says continued, it's almost like he didn't even put his hand down. Go ahead.
Okay. There to have exclusive power of legislation, but how? Wherever they may have this district, they must possess it from the authority of the state within which it lies, and that state may stipulate the conditions of the cession. Will not such state take care of the liberties of its own people? What would be the consequence if the seat of government of the United States, with all the archives of America, was in the power of any one particular state? Would not this be most unsafe and humiliating? Do we not all remember that in the year 1783, a band of soldiers went and insulted Congress? The sovereignty of the United States was treated with indignity. They applied for protection to the state they resided in, but could obtain none. It is to be hoped such a disgraceful scene will never happen again, but that for the future, the national government will be able to protect itself. The powers of the government are particularly enumerated and defined. They can claim no powers, but such as are so enumerated, in my opinion, they're excluded as much from the exercise of any other authority as they could be by the strongest negative clause that could be framed. A gentleman has asked, what would be the consequence if they had power of the purse and sword? I ask, in what government under heaven are these not given up to some authority or other? There is a necessity of giving both the purse and the sword to every government, or else it cannot protect the people.
Okay, so any comments? Because we actually read the part of this before where they talked about the secession and so forth in Virginia. And I don't think Mr. Iredell kind of understood, you know, that. But actually, the one thing that I thought you would have a question, do we not all remember that in the year 1783, a band of soldiers went and insulted Congress?
Right.
They talked about that before, too. And okay. I'm not sure if that's when George Washington intervened or whether it was after the Constitution. But I do know George Washington intervened at one point where these men were basically saying, you owe us. You know, we fought this war and you have yet to pay us.
Right.
Right. So I'm here to tell you, folks, that things don't change. Because they stuck it to those guys that they promised to fight the war. We hear people today say we owe it to these guys that, you know, are willing to give the ultimate sacrifice and go serve. Well, I was promised free medical and free dental for life, and I ain't getting that.
Quick question. They stuck it to these guys. Was that ever resolved?
So actually, at least in this context, it was later brought up that they were given, and as a matter of fact, they talked about it, I think, in North Carolina, where they were forced to actually print money to basically give to the soldiers so that they had money.
Okay.
So that they were compensated to some degree. And they said, you know, hey, we had to regret that we did that, but it was necessary. We had no other choice.
It was the paper money thing.
Yes, it was the paper money issue. Right. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So now we are still in enumerated powers, right? And looks like Mr. Bloodworth is speaking. You want to go there?
Okay, so we're actually commerce. Anti-federalist commerce. Comment, right? Yep.
All right. Mr. Bloodworth observed that the first convention, which met to consult on the necessary alterations of the Confederation so as to make it efficient and put the commerce of the United States in a better footing, not consisting of a sufficient number from the different states so as to authorize them to proceed, returned without effecting anything, but proposed that another convention should be called to have more extensive powers to alter and amend the Confederation. This proposition of that convention was warmly opposed in Congress. Mr. King from Massachusetts insisted on the impropriety of the measure and that the existing system ought to stand as it was. His arguments, he said, were that it might destroy the Confederation to propose alterations, that the unanimous consent of all states was necessary to introduce those alterations, which could not possibly be obtained, and that it would therefore be in vain to attempt it. He wondered how gentlemen came to entertain different opinions now. He declared he had listened with attention to the arguments of the gentleman on the other side and had endeavored to remove every kind of bias from his mind, yet he had heard nothing of sufficient weight to induce him to alter his opinion. He was sorry that there was any division on that important occasion and wished they could all go hand in hand. So this is another one who believed that, you know, the commission was exceeded, apparently.
Basically, correct. I mean, he was making that assertion. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. And so, right. But I don't think he wanted Mr. Spate to get back up and kind of slap him around like the other guy.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't know. You know, GR, we're going through this pretty fast. Now we're in Declaration of Rights, correct?
That is correct. So now they've kind of gotten through, and if you read before this, they get into some resolutions because, and let me see here, Friday. Okay, so actually, this is Friday, August 1st, 1788. And so they go in and they create a Declaration of Rights. And so when we go through this, they create... Maybe it was just a feeble attempt, because in trying to create these resolutions and trying to create these amendments and so forth, they were trying to appease the naysayers. And I believe that those who convened this convention felt, you know, they kind of, you know, listened and they didn't think that they could get across the line. And instead of rejecting the Constitution, they tabled the Constitution for 1 year to really look at what. And actually, it was only because the government formed in May of 89, and they ratified later on, I think 5-6 months later.
Okay.
So, you know, they just wanted to table it to, you know, just to make sure that the federal government was going in the direction that, you know, it was being sold as, and it did. It went down that path. Had they waited till 1794... then they could have said, oh, you know, shoot, Hamilton's made these implications of power, you know, and rightfully so, they'd say, well, now we're concerned. Mm-hmm. In other words, there may have been merit for a few states to say, we're going to stay out of this for 10 years.
Mm.
We want to have an accord or a treaty with you that will be kind of equal, but we're going to stay out of this for 10 years because we want to prove, you know, we want you to prove to us that you're not going to try to redefine or do a switch and bait or anything like that, that you're going to live by this Constitution that you've ratified.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to keep you honest. Right. That makes sense, right?
So, yeah. No, it does make sense. So here we've got, let me ask you a question then. At this point, it looks like pretty much the debating is over. Okay, they're talking, so... I think they're proposing here a Declaration of Rights, and I see here amendments to the Constitution. So
right.
It looks like they're doing these things as part of the convention for, as you said, you know, they're trying to appease the people that are concerned about the lack of a Bill of Rights, right?
Correct, correct, correct. So okay. When we look at this, as we dive into this, we could easily cover this in probably a day, maybe two, because it's several pages. It's several pages of reading. Because let me see here. We start off here. So that's one page. That's two pages. There's three, four pages in the first few. And then we go down to the final amendments, which is another page.
Two pages.
So I can honestly see that, you know, this would probably take a day or two. So next week we'll dive into these. Actually, we got about 3 minutes. Is there anything that I could actually lend to? And actually, so they did a resolution here, and this was done by Mr. Davey. And this is right before they go into the Declaration of Rights. And he says, resolve.
I see that.
That a Declaration of Rights asserting and securing from encroachment the great principles of civil and religious liberty and the inalienable rights of the people, together with amendments to the most ambiguous and exceptionable parts of the said constitution of government, ought to be laid before Congress and the convention of the states that shall or may be called for the purpose of amending the said constitution for their consideration previous to the ratification of the constitution aforesaid on the part of the state of North Carolina. So, boom. So this is what they were saying. And the bottom line is, they wanted to see these amendments. They wanted to see some good faith before they actually ratified. And so there it is right there.
So question. So North Carolina did this.
Uh-huh.
What was the response of the other states to this? Apparently, there was some time went by, and then North Carolina comes back. So my next question is, Is there an addendum to this? In other words, we have the record of North Carolina returning. That would be included in the ratification debates also, right?
We have the what?
Okay, so this ended with this. They didn't do it here.
In other words, yes, they basically created these resolutions and or declarations, amendments, and so forth, and they went their own way, waiting. And what ended up happening was, for whatever reason, I would have to look and see if there's any language, because they actually closed this out that year. And then, the convention afterwards to the business of fixing the seat of government, and on Monday, the 4th of August, adjourned Sendai and Sinidai or whatever. And so basically they ended. August 2nd or August 4th. So I'm of the opinion that there was something that, you know, we'd have to look at, you know, what it took to convene them again, because we don't have that documentation. Did they just get together and vote or what?
In other words, that was my question.
Yeah, so we're out of time.
They came back together.
Yep, and unfortunately, Paul, we're out of time, but we'll actually cover all of this as we lead into this next week on Tuesday, because that's our content day, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. It's like Sunday school, folks. You're coming here to learn, and you're coming here to learn the truth of the Constitution, just like you go learn the truth of the gospel. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.